Matthew. Oh, top of the screen. This tendency to essentialize human experience and events could also be found in the third type of dance performed by the dance brigade, what I would call the lyrical dramatic solo. These dances, entitled Restitution, or Give Me Water, or Resolution for Africa, represented emotivity itself. They depicted feelings of horror and outrage, frustration, fear, hope, and generosity as responses to imaginary forces existing out in the world, as well as in the dancer's own psyche. In each piece, the dancer seemed to lash out, fall back, make another attempt. She yearned to speak, but what there was to say seemed inexpressible. She was dancing because there was no other response so primal or authentic to social injustice. As witnesses to her expressive act, the audience mutely communed with the powerful presence of unmitigated feeling. But what was accomplished by these soulful outpourings? Was the dancer saying that resolution in Africa will consist of a precarious balancing of antagonistic forces achieved after many unsuccessful attempts? That we can never know the terror and anguish experienced by the victims of Hiroshima? That we as women have the emotional competence to empathize with such experiences? I would contend that because these dances only replicated cliches, they reaffirmed the hierarchy of social values that we referred to at the beginning of our talk this afternoon, that both equate and then discriminate against women, dance, and the body. In other words, these dances tend to relegate women and dance to the realm of the purely emotional, intuitive, and inarticulate, and they show a body harnessed in dumb service to an expressive self. Now, as one of three very different types of dances presented by the Dance Brigade, these solos contributed to the diversity of styles presented by the group. Together with the other dances, they served to establish a complex image of women as astute social critics, as serious campaigners against social injustice, and as extra-sensitive human beings capable of empathizing with the plights of others. Each of these roles for women, with its corresponding vocabulary of physical skills, complimented and even commented upon the others. And it was this reflexivity in the form of the concert that seemed to contain the Dance Brigade's strongest message. I think that message is that women are all these things. On their own, however, or in conjunction with pieces about specific political events, the lyrical solos would have the effect of reducing political circumstances to an all too common denominator, that of struggle or pain or oppression. And they would tend to reduce women's experiences to woman's experience. And fortunately, Kate Stimson made a great sort of argument about why that's not a good strategy to take at this point. Studies this morning. Let me turn to Johanna Boyce now, a New York-based choreographer whose work over the past few years has increasingly dealt with feminist issues. She makes use of several methods for deconstructing the narrative sequence in order to ensure a more complex representation of her subjects. Unlike the Dance Brigade, we use spoken text to identify a specific topic which is then depicted in the movement. Voice treats movement and text as independent discourses that occasionally intersect. Voice's subjects, far more personal than those chosen by the Dance Brigade, develop their feminist orientation out of the particulars of the dancers' lives. Where the Dance Brigade uses poems, already abstracted versions of human experience, Voice adapts the autobiographical musings of the dancers. But these reminiscences do not tell a story so much as delineate a topos. Individual statements are fragmented, reversed, reordered, and intercalated with statements by another dancer, while at the same time, phrases of movement treated using the same organizing procedures echo, amplify, and contrast the verbal statements. I'm going to show you an excerpt from a Boyce work called Ties That Bind. And I think what, I'm just going to show you like a couple minutes of this. What you'll notice is that sometimes the movement illustrates the spoken text, or sometimes it evokes a complementary image to the spoken text, or sometimes it diverges entirely in quality and subject matter from the spoken text. Now, do all of that in 2 minutes.
My name is Sydney. I was born in Covington, Georgia, in 1938. My father was in dental school, and my mother was working as a secretary to support me. I'm Annual, and I was born in Philadelphia, in the city of brotherhood and love. My father was a mechanical engineer, and my mother was a mother. She had been a home ec teacher before my sister was born. My sister is 3 years older than me. I'm 4 years older than my sister. And there are only two of us in the family. One month after she was born, I got a young twin. She got sick and caught pneumonia and had to be hospitalized. My mother left home to go into isolation with her for 6 weeks, leaving me with my father. He was really busy with his new dental practice. I think I spent a lot of time in daycare centers. My father loved to take my sister and I on that trip. He'd get us up at 5 in the morning to go skiing, and he'd take us to the highest trail on the top of the mountain. I'd be wearing tons of clothes and still be freezing cold. It was really scary.
I wish, I mean,
my grandparents made it.
I'm going to make him listen to me instead.
Even in pieces without spoken text, voices found ways to create scenarios that support multiple interpretations. In The Coming of a Man, for example, a group of male dancers perform complicated sequences of simple steps, hops, gallops, and turns that create various patterns in space. The dancers move in and out of lines, they form diagonals or circles, they disperse and reconvene, all the while maintaining the constant rhythm and momentum of the fast-paced footwork. After several minutes, voice enters, an obvious female body, but dressed like the men in shirts and pants, tie and tennis shoes. She executes the same steps and fits gracefully into the spatial patterns created by the group. Gradually, however, each man's steps take him in a different direction off stage, so that eventually voice is left dancing alone. This simple disposition of dancers suggests many different meanings. It is a dance that alludes to discrimination against women, and also to women trying to look and act like men. And yet both of these interpretations contain additional complexities. Voice, for example, does not look uncomfortable doing the movement, for it is the epitome of an androgynous vocabulary, privileging neither male-associated capacities for strength and endurance or female-associated capacities for ornamentation and lyricism. Thus, although it suggests it, the dance does not enact the stereotype of the woman leaving behind all feminine virtues in order to enter the man's world. Furthermore, the men acting not as a fraternal unit, but as an aggregate of independent individuals whose movements happen to interconnect, seem at the end of the piece to have wandered off in pursuit of their own interests. They are just doing their own thing, and it just happens to break up shortly after a woman enters. Because there is no confrontation, no obvious reaction to voice on the part of the man, any accusation of discrimination is circumstantial. I think this is the kind of dance Foucault would like. Okay? Like so much of the sexual and racial discrimination that occurs in our society today, there is no obvious bad guy. Power, rather than being wielded by some individual, is located in the cultural system of behaviors that are danced out by all of us. In Becoming the Man, as in many of Boyce's dances, the use of an ordinary pedestrian movement vocabulary contributes to the multiple meanings contained in the piece. Where the dance brigade create traditional narrative structures using diverse movement vocabularies, Boyce uses a mundane vocabulary to draw attention to possible relationships between choreographic structure and meaning. The viewer focuses less on specific moves and more on the formal manipulation of those moves. As a result, the audience is encouraged to watch the narrative being made. They become involved in the process of meaning production. I think you're going to get a sense of that just from that brief look at the video. This is all well and good if the audience is willing to consider what they are watching dance. Because the dancers look like ordinary people who have worked hard to attain specific skills required for the performance, viewers may delight in the accessibility of Boyce's dances, in the idea that they too, given enough practice, could perform such a piece. On the other hand, they could dismiss as unprofessional the untrained dancers and the simple movement skills. Now, I'm voicing this possible objection to Boyce's work in order to return to my opening anecdote about the Wallflower Order. I don't think that I was all right and they were all wrong for studying ballet. I do think that because they have now within their repertory a set of skills that can impress an audience, that their work is more suitable for presentation in a variety of contexts. I've seen them work in parks, okay, or in a symphony space with equal grace and effectiveness. Boyce's work, in contrast, it seems to me, is best seen up close and framed by a theatrical space that empowers it to be viewed as high art. It would be dismissed in a lot of situations. In Ties That Bind and in other dances by Boyce, we see a more specialized vocabulary, one that seems to grow directly out of the pedestrian repertoire, but that takes a decidedly feminine turn. In these dances, flow is emphasized over shape. The body, life, adaptable and organic, courses through space, ever sensitive to the motions surrounding it, always capable of accommodating and interacting with other bodies. Often, movement will erupt in an unpredictable part of the body, with the rest of the body following sequentially. The body rapidly gathers momentum, tumbling, circulating, and unfolding, gradually decelerating, only to begin the process again. Where the body does pause, taking on a shape, it does not mold itself to conform to a set of abstract lines, as in the ballet, but instead arrests itself mid-sequence to create organic, dynamic configurations. This sequentiality of body parts and phrasing of movement suggests an intuitive, spontaneous frame of mind. Any part of the body can think up a movement. The head, normally in charge of overseeing the performance or providing special information about the feelings of the dancers, simply goes along for the ride. The entire body responds quickly to any body part, lending an unpredictable continuity to the movement that is reminiscent of direct apprehension rather than studied reason. So that what I'm saying here is that like the dance brigade's lyrical solos, these dancers seem to celebrate the virtues of woman as other. Both sets of dances portray women as sensitive, feeling-filled, instinctive, impulsive, and inspired. The vocabulary used by the dance brigade, however, involves a set of physical skills that require a self to command the body. Boyce's vocabulary, while just as contrived, nonetheless features the body's own logic, its actual weight, its lumpiness, sleekness, and agility. The self does not control the body so much as merge with it. Thus, the lyrical vocabulary of the dance brigade solos shows a more traditional image of woman as a self that uses a body as the most appropriate vehicle for expressing its concerns, whereas Boyce's choreography depicts a version of the liberated woman as athletic as well as sensitive, who revels in her own intuitive abilities. Both sets of dances, however, run the risk of celebrating woman by enshrining her in a new place. And I would argue that that's a place that contemporary society is only too willing to accommodate, and one that does not effectively resist the oppression of women. Boyce usually retrieves her stereotypes of women in one of several ways. Either the dancers talk while moving, as you just saw, or they engage in complex rhythmic and spatial patterns that belie the craft involved in creating the seemingly spontaneous dance. Or, like the Dance Brigade, they suddenly shift characters altogether and begin a dance that pokes fun at both feminine and feminist stereotypes. Thus, in Daughters of Taboo, one of Boyce's pieces, a chorus of well-intentioned but clumsy dancers dressed as gaudy versions of Las Vegas showgirls create a star attraction out of one of their comrades, who is a more expert, bearded woman juggler. Together, they valiantly toss balls, wiggling their shoulders and hips with inept sexiness to the Latin hustle music, occasionally allowing the principal juggler to show off her virtuosity. The piece and Boyce's concert on which I saw this piece climax in a final mischievous image. The juggler winks at the audience as she cradles two of the orbs in her hand. Clearly, these women have mankind by the balls. At the same time, Boyce's dancers are mocking themselves. Their own ineptness softens as it satirizes the aggressive challenge to men in the choreography. This reflexivity, found also in the Dance Brigade's diverse vocabulary and in Boyce's treatment of spoken and danced texts, and in both groups' wonderful sense of humor, creates the opportunity for dancers and viewers alike to contemplate their own cultural specificity. By getting us laughing, as Stimson did this morning, or by engaging us in the process of sorting through multiple interpretations, these dances overpower our tendency and their own to essentialize this experience. They remind us of the particulars of our circumstances. They also remind us that women's experiences, like women's bodies, are protean and changeable, as are our strategies for resistance. She looks over the glasses meaningfully. Okay, well, we have a few minutes to talk, right?
Yeah.
She's a 50-yard dad.
George, you can't have a comment.
I'd like to respond or talk a little bit about the idea of the technique used by the body, either in voice or in the walk follow order. It seems like there are quite a few problems involved. Like the walk follow order, taking the balletic technique to appeal to a larger group of people, for one thing, is taking on the construction that we're used to in the body, that's been developed by a patriarchal system, which is going to go against the, like, as you said, the message that they were trying to portray. So you can't just take a technique appropriated to express another message and not take the message that's assuming the body has no cultural construction just in that act. But we can take this idea of the lift in the body, the further extension, the vertical, and not have the meanings or associations that we normally take along with that baggage. And then assuming, I think, taking the assumption that the voice work is less logical, more intuitive, is accepting that the very dichotomy that the ballet is a more logical system. Just because it's a new technique or it's a new construction rather than something that's closer and more intuitive to the body. Do you know what I mean?
I think we're arguing the same thing. You know, that both techniques signify different things. That the wallflower order, at least in this intermediary period when I saw them and when they had their brand new ballet technique, really significantly undermined themselves. I don't think that they do so much anymore, at least in this recent concert, because someone must have told them that their Aikido was really hot stuff, because they put a lot of that back in their concerts and a lot of other kinds of movement as well, so that we don't see them as the National Ballet of China, dancing the Red Guard revolution in ballet. We don't see them doing that
I think it, I get a little bit more confused when you get to the voice example, you know, to say that that's a less logical, more intuitive use of the body. Whereas it seems to me, if we're, maybe that's in contrast to defining, as ballet is defined as a logical use of the body. Because of, or are you saying?
No, what I'm saying is that it signifies an intuitive frame of mind. Okay, what this kind of movement makes us think is that these people are just making it up right now, or just responding, okay, to their environments. Okay, that's, I mean, that's part of what it tends to signify for us. And what I'm saying is that that undermines her feminist message.
Well, didn't you also? I wonder how to get away from that then, because it seems that in some ways any system that doesn't use the predominant logical definition of the logical use of the body is going to be seen or signified in certain contexts as intuitive.
Oh, well, I think she gets away from it by having her dancers talk at the same time, okay? Or by presenting narrative structures that are very open-ended, so that you have all these different possible interpretations of them.
I guess it really depends on the reception of the person watching. Because I don't see it as less logical and more intuitive.
I don't think logical is the right word.
Yeah.
I mean, it's more conscious than logical, because intuitive in our bodies, I think, is naturally more logical for ourselves than, you know, and for, as far as being harmful to our bodies is concerned, you know, as opposed to like all these grandiose movements which don't seem logical at all in terms of harm.
I think that what's being pointed to here is are certain socially or culturally accepted meanings for certain uses of the body.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, that actually this refers to the same kind of contrast that that I see between ballet and contact improvisation, so that free flow and that inward focus are associated with intuitive movement, and it does come in part from the actual practice, but it also then just takes on a symbolic meaning, so that someone could get up and do a choreographed phrase that. You know, had been absolutely set and worked out beforehand, that had this sort of free flow and internal focus, and the audience says, oh, intuition. I mean, not in so many words, but it has that kind of communication to us.
Yeah, Duncan, too. I mean, that inward focus is what read as intuitive.
Isn't it true also that when you learn, so when you do content improvisation, sometimes you do a particular step and someone will say, might criticize you by saying that wasn't the logical progression from the last move you did. Somehow, that you stepped out of something instead of letting it follow its quote unquote natural or organic course, and that in a sense would be against the logic of that technique.
Yes, they would never use the word logic, but yes, they would use the word follow through the physical momentum. That is, actually, for contact improvisation, I think probably for a lot of voices work, the concept of gravity and of natural laws of physics assumes a kind of primacy as being something that is natural.
True, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Even though I think you can argue that it is as constructed as other uses of the body, and certainly the adherence to it as an ideology is a construction. Yes, and it does take a long time to learn.
And that goes far back in modern dance. I mean, that was
modern dances have always talked about how natural,
and therefore it somehow following, you know, the kinetics.
Yeah.
So are you saying that if you have a woman alone on stage or just women on stage doing this sort of movement that looks intuitive and looks like they're responding to some human vibrant that aren't being manipulated and aren't manipulating space, that it undermines a, you know, a sense of strength in you, or a sense of like you can have strength, you know, some sort of control?
Not so much that as it does reinforce a stereotype about what woman is anyway.
An intuitive,
yes,
hearing.
Yes.
But then if you put women and men on stage together doing it, like in kind of improv, it's just an entirely different
Yes. It says this is interaction, this is mutual, like,
women can be as strong as men.
And it works like this.
You have a set of process,
women.
I think what we constantly confront is the fact that so many aspects of our lives are defined in terms of the male-female dichotomy, and it's very hard for us to move out of that dichotomy, to either do things that are imitative of a stereotype for the opposite sex, or fall into the stereotype of our own sex, and to move into something new is something that takes a lot of imagination, and I think a lot of pursuing different threads, as Susan pointed out, and that it's going to take a long time to create new forms.
And I also think that not just the creation of new forms, but the whole way of perceiving what we're seeing.
That's
because,
true.
I mean, anybody seeing two women doing a contact improv is likely to say, oh, these are two people supporting each other, helping each other, two sort of maybe weak creatures helping each other like sisters, you know, that sort of, rather than when it's a man and a woman, it's like, oh, okay, that's equality, that's this. And there's certain ideas that we have set, I mean, when we see things, and depending on if it's a man or a woman, I think, you know, we give it a certain interpretation.
That's right, and the point being that, you know, no particular, you know, technique or image or form, you know, has any set universal meaning. I mean, it's all accessible to interpretation, and interpretation always depends on context. So they can, you know, free flow can be read in one way in one context and in another way in another context.
You mentioned the problem with constructing images of the body.
Well, let me try to answer that and maybe relate it to the other two talks as well. I think that a contact improvisation by the 1980s really had a social base taken away from it. So the communal living situations that a lot of people were immersed in the 70s when they were doing contact improvisation no longer existed. So that it becomes then a form, and it's the question of how long can that form really be imbued with the same power that it had earlier. The movement itself then can just become a means for facility, something by which you explore a kind of athletic virtuosity, which is interesting, but it does not have the same meaning as it had. There's also this whole question of the construction of the body. It seems to me that the American body is highly sexually charged, and we just almost always think of the body as a sexual or social entity, and that when I look at other cultures, I see that that's not necessarily true. And I think it's just very hard in all of the descriptions of dance from different periods of time that we've heard today, all of these American dance forms take cognizance of sexuality in one way or another. Conflicted sexuality that Susan was talking about, the stereotypes of sexuality that Susan Foster was talking about. In contact improvisation, there's a certain transcendence of sexual roles because there is not this gender differentiation. But in order to not have the body interpreted as being sexual, when in fact you're lying on top of another person and rolling around with them, the body just becomes totally desexualized, and the social implications can easily be removed from it. Now, anyone watching it, of course, can put those interpretations into it. And I find that when contact improvisation is well done, I can see many kinds of meanings and implications in it. It's a very rich art form, but it's very easily reduced to this purely physical display. It can be something that is just the body. It's asexual. It's not necessarily the thinking body, even though contact improvisers see it as that. But it becomes the body as something that performs these fantastic athletic feats. And it becomes co-opted into an image in the 80s of the body as this wonderful instrument that runs and gets itself in shape and executes skills and kick the legs higher and we jump higher, and dancers have never been so technically proficient as they've been now.
And contact can even fall into that, even though its original conception was the opposite of that. It was very opposite of that.
It's interesting to get to an image of gender equality in that case, and it seems that we've had to erase difference and erase sexuality.
Yeah, that's right. And then if they're making bodies equal means makes them both kind of these athletically effective instruments, I mean, what kind of equality is that?
Is there some type of basic plan behind the content evaluation, or is it totally improvised?
Well, it is totally improvised within this very narrow structure that the two people are supposed to maintain physical contact and derive their movement sequences from the movement in space generated by giving and taking weight.
So you would not really ever be able to see the same performance twice?
No, but you would certainly recognize it as contact improvisation because it would involve this very particular style. So there's something I should mention that for those of you who are just starting to look at dance that you always need to remember, and that is dancers, like most people, usually have one thing to say when they describe what they do, and when they tell you their ideals and beliefs, and then what they actually do is often something very different. So contact improvisers will tell you that they're just improvising, and that it's completely free and open, and then of course it has a very clear and set structure to it. That's just not something they explicitly acknowledge very often.
What types of groups
Well,
on the regular.
Right now, the people who do it on a regular basis are really people who meet socially in different cities or around the country and engage in what they call these jams. And they're really dances. People just come in and dance, and anybody can come to them.
So not exactly performances?
Not anymore. In the 70s, a lot of people performed contact improvisation, and they simply took what they did in a jam and did it in front of an audience. But that kind of demonstration performance is something that has become harder and harder to do for varying reasons. I'm sure you can guess some of them.
There are also classes
people study in too, yes. Occasionally there's a contact improvisation performance, and you would probably see it advertised in the Village Voice, not in the New York Times, because it wouldn't be big enough to take it out.
Where they would do contact improvisation initially, then it was thought it was air. The answer that they would do an improvisation and then record it after before they could finish the things.
Yeah, there's a definite relationship, and you're right in perceiving the similarity.
It's interesting to ask a workshop that they were doing more of this.
I think we should say that we'll stick around and talk to people for a while, but we would just like to thank you all. And also,
there's been a kind of interesting series this year at Columbia, sponsored by the Center for American Culture Studies, called Dance in American Culture. Cynthia has curated it. I'm speaking next week, and Cynthia and Susan are speaking in a couple weeks. But anyway, there are flyers. You can kind of see what that's about.
Don't know about it.